You're listening to the Just One Outdoors podcast.
Hey guys, Austin here, and as many of you guys know, I'm going on a backcountry elk hunt this September, and part of that is getting fit and being ready to be at my peak when I step foot on that mountain. And I've partnered with Fit to Hunt. Jeremy and the team over there have a lot of stuff going for them. They have some do-it-yourself workouts that you can get. They're 6 weeks long. They're really good programs. They also have some personal training, some shirts that you can get. Definitely want you guys to check them out. They have helped me out a lot and gearing up for turkey season right now. But after turkey season, we're going to really hit it hard and get ready for elk. So I've had great results using Fit to Hunt and what they've offered me. So I highly, highly recommend them. If you're interested in anything Fit to Hunt has to offer, go to our website, justoneoutdoors.com. Go under the partners tab and you can click a link that'll take you directly to their website. And there's a bunch of stuff on there that I think will benefit you.
All right. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is a special episode. Finally got one of my friends on, and I call him a friend. Started more as a coworker. Bobby, welcome to the show. We're happy to have you. It's been a long time in the making, but we're happy to have you on.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So just a little backstory. Bobby and I worked together in Springfield for a year or so as I was an intern. Ended up leaving the company after I graduated, came back, and we worked together for a few months, and it was awesome. And then all of a sudden, you decided you were going to leave. And so now we kind of work together, but I have to call you like once a week just to talk to you.
I don't know about once a week. It seems like it's almost every other day. We'll just kind of put our headphones in and sit in silence and listen to each other breathe or something.
It actually does happen a little bit.
Mostly just listening to your keyboard clicking around and mouse.
But oh, you get that too? He'll call me and be like, "Hey, I have something to tell you," and then it's. I'm like, yeah, wait, what?
I'm known in the office anymore as having a loud keyboard. But, you know, I just say it sounds like hard work. So, so Bobby, before we get into it too much, I appreciate, all the advice you've given me hunting. And you know, it's funny. I think about, my run in with conservation and just telling you about it afterward, and you're like, yeah, someone is going to show up and get you for that. But I definitely miss all the times where you come over to my desk or I go over to your desk and we just talk about hunting or fishing or whatever. And I definitely have to give you a shout out too, because I killed my first deer out of the saddle this year. And I was pretty much using all of your gear, which I still have. Except for the saddle, but I got your climbing gear broken in this year.
Yeah, that's perfect. Well, somebody's got to do it.
I know. Now that you've moved up there, I don't know if you're ever going to use it.
Well, this last year was really wild. I usually do quite a bit of hunting, and with moving and looking for land and houses and everything, it's been so hectic that I really didn't get to do as much hunting as I like to. So I'm glad that somebody else was able to at least use that gear. I usually shoot, you know, several deer a year, not a lot of monsters or anything. You know, I'm not like a big buck hunter or anything, but, I like to fill the freezer, feed a lot of deer, and, it's something that we like to go to. So, just filling the freezer is my main thing.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you've sort of rubbed off on me a little bit, definitely with bow hunting, because I got into it a lot more talking to you about it. And it's funny, when I started bow hunting, I was shooting a pretty cheap bow. I was using like whatever arrows I could find, basically. I mean, hodgepodge. And you're over here, you ended up giving me some of your old arrows, and you'd put them in the bathtub and put a mark on, you know, where the spine was, and just took things to another level. I don't know if I'll ever be at that level, but you definitely opened my eyes to how serious you can get into bow hunting. So just, I'm curious because I haven't really asked you, how did you get into hunting? How did you start? And you did some, you know, I guess competition shooting too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't get real serious into the competition side, but, I do like, I enjoy going to 3D shoots. I know Austin's been to a few of those and it's addicting. You know, being able to shoot at an animal shaped target and guessing your yardages and just really testing your equipment and yourself. It's pretty enjoyable, I think. So, but yeah, I got into hunting when I was a little kid. We used to go up to my grandparents' farm every year and rifle hunt mainly. I really didn't get into bow hunting until about college, beginning of college. But when I was 10, I was up at my grandparents' deer hunting and I got to go with my grandpa. I usually go with my dad, but that day he had tagged out on a nice 10 point and he's like, you know what, why don't you come with me and we'll go hunt the stand I usually go to, which when I say stand, they're hunting out of a 5x10 hut with sliding windows and stairs leading up into them. So we got little buddy heaters and it, as a kid, it was like the greatest thing on earth. Toes are freezing and you get to put your foot up to this nice warm buddy heater. so we're sitting in the stand and I hear, you know, I'm barely tall enough to see out the windows really. So sitting in the chair, I can hardly see. I'm kind of just like getting up on my knees to look out the window and see what's in the field. And all of a sudden my grandpa kind of looks over and says, don't move, here comes a deer. And before long, I could kind of start hearing it right outside. And I'm like, it's close. And so I stand up and I look straight down and right under our hut is a 14 point, I think it was 158 inch buck. Oh, and at the time, it's kind of funny, he didn't have his glasses with him. And so he knew it was a good sized buck, but he didn't know how big. And so the buck walks around kind of to our left and gets right behind a cedar tree. And so at that point, he gets me up. Kind of sets me up in the chair tall enough that I can shoot. I think I was even on like a phone book or something in the chair just so I'd be tall enough to even see through the scope. And he sets me up. He's got a Browning 22-250. Like really nice gun. I love that gun.
I have no idea what that is, but sounds legit.
It's a small bullet that shoots really fast. And it's kind of, It's a really accurate bullet, but it's smaller and it shoots really fast. There's not usually a really big blood trail with them, but I love that gun. It's got decent kick, but it's a heavy gun, so it, you know, it's really not bad. So I'm shooting it, and the deer comes out. He's like, all right, he's standing behind this cedar tree. When he steps out, you're going to have to shoot fast because he kind of seems like he was either catching our wind or knew something wasn't quite right. And he steps out just enough to shoot. I shoot at him. He runs off. He runs kind of behind a pond dam that's about 80 yards away. And so he repositions me around that pond dam to where I could shoot when he comes out the other side of the pond dam. And about 5-10 minutes pass, he never comes out. He's like, are you sure you hit him? I was like, I mean, I was holding right on him, you know? Because I don't know. It didn't look like he hit him. I don't know. We'll go look for blood, but you know, he wasn't real hopeful. I'm like, oh, man, what did I do wrong? I was right on him. And so we get down and we start on the backside of the dam, kind of where he would have been heading. And we walk towards where I shot. And sure enough, he had died right before he jumped the fence, kind of right behind that pond dam. He only ran probably, you know, 60, 80 yards probably. And we get up to it. And as soon as we get close enough to it, he says, he used some curse words at the time, but he says, you know, basically, you shot my buck. Apparently, he had been hunting that buck the whole season. And since he had tagged out, I was able to get the buck that he was actually after.
Oh, man.
So it's just a funny story. And then, the whole way, I remember walking back to the truck. I'm, you know, 10 years old. I can just remember it like it was yesterday, it seems like. But, and I'm just, you know, hopping back and forth and on cloud nine, it seems like. But that's probably my most memorable hunt as far as deer hunting goes. Obviously I shot a big buck, so it's kind of hard to forget that.
Man, your story reminds me a lot of mine, just like growing up hunting and then getting into archery hunting in college, and also shooting my buck wasn't that big, but I shot a nice big Illinois 8-point, my first buck, big swollen buck, and, you know, haven't killed anything as big since. I'm wondering, is that your biggest buck, or have you killed bigger?
That is my biggest. Yep. I kind of got ruined from the start, it seems like. I've been chasing, and I've seen some good bucks that are bigger than that. Never had a shot at one, though.
Well, you cheated. You moved from Southwest Missouri up north to the land of, when everyone thinks Missouri hunting, they think they're thinking Northern Missouri. That's where all our big bucks are, with all the corn and beans and all that. So, you kind of, I'd be surprised if you didn't see some massive ones up there.
Yeah. I'm trying to get back into it up here. This is it's a different ball game. And even further north than where I am, it just seems to get better.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I think you've got a pretty good chance if you can just wake up and get out there.
Yep. That's, and you know, we're still looking for a land and a house up here. So it's, I'm not sure how this season's going to look yet, but we're anxious to find the one.
Well, if I was going to say, if you need help, you know, breaking in any land or anything this season, I'll volunteer.
You know a guy?
I know a guy or two.
Yeah. Hey, we could at least be some doe managers.
Hey, if we got too many does, I'm sure we could work that out.
Do a doe weekend. I've seen that stuff on YouTube where like a group of guys would go out and they'll kill like 20 does or something in a day. And it's like, man, that would be awesome. But somehow we just hunt the entire season and just kill a handful, which I'm not going to complain about. Last season was pretty awesome for Austin and I.
Yeah. You guys had an exciting season. Did a little traveling, trying to see some new areas. That looked like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was kind of our first year doing that, and I guess our first year for both of us killing deer with our bows, and we just got hooked, and really, we had some people that gave us advice to really not be picky, especially when we're getting into it, because the best way we would learn is just to get out there, make mistakes, you know, take some animals and do it that way, and I think we learned a lot last year, and thankfully, we didn't learn too much the hard way during deer season, but we had a pretty tough turkey season. So we were feeling good after deer season, then we got humbled.
Yeah, this turkey season was pretty weird. Yeah, it's like we had a cold spell that hit that first weekend, and all the birds around here just seemed to shut up, and then it's hard to get on them when they don't want to play.
Yeah, I don't know how I don't know how they are up there, but like down here on the roost, they would be the most vocal birds you'd ever find. And then as soon as they hit the ground, not a peep. You know, we were almost deer hunting them down here, just set up and try to ambush them as they come through.
Yep. We saw a lot of that, especially the first weekend, but by the time the third weekend hit, and they were firing all the way up until 11, 12 o'clock.
I wish I had that here. Our birds disappeared the third week.
You guys have quite a bit of public land though, right?
I would say about 50-50 for turkey.
Yeah. That public land turkey makes it pretty tough.
Yeah, and it's tough too when you don't have access to a bunch of private, because in an ideal world, we'd be able to hear birds somewhere and chase after them. But when you're landlocked, and we had that same issue on public too, but when you're landlocked, I mean, you're kind of just waiting to ambush them. And I will say that we had some really awesome turkey hunts, but when it turns into basically deer hunting turkey, it's not nearly as much fun as deer hunting is.
Right. Yeah, when they're not vocalizing, it can just be slow. And then all of a sudden, it can be fun. It's really just hard to tell, you know? Like hunting up here, we know quite a few of the neighbors and the farmers and stuff, so we're able to drive around and kind of find birds and then put a plan together on how to get, you know, get around on them, either follow a creek bed or, get close enough to them that you can make a play. And it's definitely helped, you know, when you're hunting a smaller property that's either public or not, and you don't have access on those neighbors. If they're not on you, well, you just go home. You know, there's no other no way to make them come to you, it seems like.
Yeah. So I'm curious. I don't know that I've asked this. Do you have any, is there a hunting story that just sticks out as being something crazy? Whether it's turkey hunting, whether it's deer hunting, I guess it could be fishing too. Has there ever been something that happened that was just like, this was kind of crazy?
Oh, that's a tough one. I would say probably, so I went elk hunting a couple years over in Colorado, and that's probably my most memorable hunt. I was out, you know, we weren't at a crazy elevation or anything, but we were out western Colorado, and we had a spot. I had a bull kind of across the draw from me. He couldn't have been maybe 150 yards. I set up in a good location and just called, and he answered right back at me. I'm like, oh man, it's on. And, you know, it kind of seemed like he was laying down maybe. It was early afternoon at that point. And he would answer, but he didn't seem like he was really changing his location. Like he's either got some cows over there with him or he's bedded up, you know? So I sat there and called a little bit longer, and he'd answer back, but he never really moved. I was like, all right, I'm going to make a move on him then. So I went down and moved probably about 80 yards closer, kind of at the bottom of the draw. There's a little bit of a creek right there. And, I set up at a location where he could come out in the opening of that creek and I'd have a perfect shot. And, so I got down there and made just a loud, you know, powerful bugle at him. And he fired right back like, okay, now I'm ready to fight. So at that point, I thought it was going to happen. I was like, you know, he's going to come right down here and he's going to be fired up and just come right in. So he came in, and of course, as all smart bulls do, he circles around and tries to come downwind from me, try to get my scent first. I was like, oh shoot, that's not going to work. So I tried to circle around. I was like, I'm just going to stay ahead of him. You know, if he tries to get downwind of me, I'm just going to meet him where he plans on coming from. And of course, trying to race a bull is not usually going to win. So it was basically me and him playing cat and mouse for about an hour, running back and forth. And eventually I never got a shot at that bull, but I would say that was my most memorable hunt, just because, you know, he had a plan of how to get below me and make sure that I was his competitor and not, you know, a predator. And, I had a plan to outsmart him, and we just kind of, I guess ultimately he won, but, I would say that's probably my most memorable hunt, just because of the excitement. And, you know, when you hear a bugling bull in your face, there's nothing really quite like it. I kind of compare it to turkey hunting on steroids.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I'm really excited. I get to go in September. Were you archery hunting?
Yeah, we were archery.
Man, was it, what week of September was it? Was it the first week?
I believe it was the third week.
Okay. So I'm going the first week. Yeah. We're trying to kind of beat the rush a little bit and get there before they've been pressured. And I'm looking forward to it just for, I mean, if I don't kill one, which I don't really expect to, just because the success rate is so low, I just want an experience like that where I'm, you know, in the game. If one thing happens the right way, I get a shot at one. But if not, you know, for an hour, 2 hours, I'm playing cat and mouse with this bull and trying to outsmart it. It's outsmarting me, and I'm really looking forward to it. So that story just gets me fired up because, you know, last week I was thinking, you know, here in, you know, 6-7 months, I'm going to be in the mountains. I have plenty of time to prepare. And then all of a sudden it hit me. It's like, 3.5 months is all I have left to dial in and be as ready as I can be. And that kind of got me excited, but also a little nervous. So with elk hunting, you have a little experience. What would your advice to me be? Like, what would your number one focus 3 months out be?
I would say, don't be afraid to move.
Okay.
Yeah. You can get away with so much more moving on a bull than, you know, you're used to whitetail hunting. Mm-hmm. Whitetails, you're in a deer stand. You don't really have any option to move, but, you know, it's very similar to turkey hunting as far as movement. You know, if you can get in close enough on them, while they're in the brush or, you know, on the other side of the ridge or whatever, make that move and get into a position where you're going to be able to shoot. Like on that bull that I hunted, you know, I'm literally like running up and down the mountain trying to get into an opening that I'll be able to shoot when they come through. And he had no idea I was there the whole time.
That's awesome.
He's, you know, approximately, I would say he was about 100 yards away most of the time. And he had no idea what I was. And so, you know, if it comes down to it and there's a bull around the corner and you don't have a good shot from where you are, make that move and get into a position where you can.
I think that's really good advice because, you know, being a whitetail hunter, I'd be like, all right, just sit and wait. He's here. Just sit and wait. He'll come. And, you know, a lot of people have told me, like, you kind of, it, like you said, turkey hind on steroids. So it's not really, you can sit and wait a little bit, but you kind of have to get into position for where they're coming to and be, you know, outsmart them if you're lucky.
Yep. Yep. And if you think, you know, oh, shoot, he's going to come over to my left instead of my right and I need to make this move, I would just, as fast as you can, make it and just get into that position. Because, you know, unless they can visually see you, they have no recollection of what you are or where you are. And another thing I would recommend is kind of play around with your calls. Like if you've got a herd bull that you think is a dominant bull there, try to sound like a younger bull and act like you're coming in, and they'll be more likely to come in and push you away, you know?
Yeah.
I remember one hunt specifically with my father-in-law out there. We got it set up on this bull and he was kind of up on the mountain. He's got some ankle issues. So he's like, I'm not going to go up there. Like, well, you know, it was last day. I'm going to make an attempt. So I started climbing up this mountain and I got up. He was just over the ridge from me and he started going down the other ridge instead of coming up, you know, on my side. And he'd call back and forth with me, but he would never just commit to come in. So he actually just kind of walked back down the mountain at that point. He was like, I'm not chasing him. There's no point. So I just kind of walked back to the truck, back to where he was. And by the time I got there, I get down to the bottom of that mountain and my father-in-law is calling a bull. I'm like, well, what? Where'd that bull come from? Turns out the bull that I was after came down the other side of the ridge, circled around, and started coming in on him.
Oh so, my gosh.
Should have sat there the whole time and had a chance apparently. But he gets set up on it and his call is a very dominant bugle. And I thought, you know, I can make my call sound like a young bull and I think it might get this guy to actually commit. And I was like, hey, let me try to give it a call. And as soon as I called, he fired off and I knew it was on. It's like, you know, he's ready to kick this bull's butt. And he came in. We had an opportunity at that bull, but ended up not getting him.
Man.
But I just noticed, you know, that was one thing I pulled from that event was just that, you know, changing your call and sounding like a different bull can get him fired up and get him to actually commit to you.
Hmm. Sounds very similar to like turkey hunting, you know, trying to sound like that Jake trying to come in and, you know, just making that Tom mad and mad enough to come, you know, defend his territory.
Yeah, very similar.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think you hit home something too that I think Austin and I have always heard people talk about, but we've definitely learned a little bit more this past year, especially during turkey season. But if you try and outsmart some of these animals, I mean, it's not going to work. ultimately they are a lot smarter than we give them credit for, and they'll do things the complete opposite way that you would think. It's, at least it seems like that's how it happens a lot of the time. I was hunting with Dylan, which Bobby and I, we work with him, and we had a tom fired up first day of turkey season this year. And, you know, he's coming straight towards my face. And then all of a sudden he kind of veers off and goes all the way around us and, you know, circles us just out of range. I mean, probably 50, 60 yards away. And I can hear it running through the trees around us, like literally going in a circle around us, and ends up putting itself between me and then the decoy out in front of me. And then there's a pretty big cedar tree on the other side, and he starts drumming and doing all that stuff. But, you know, of course, the way that we thought he was going to come in, if he'd done that, it would have been 20-yard shot. But he just did the complete opposite and outsmarted us.
It's amazing how they can get away sometimes.
It's crazy. And, you know, we've had deer do that kind of stuff too, where you just get so convinced, whether it's, okay, I've seen them on camera do this, this, and this. And then, of course, you go out there and they're nowhere to be seen, or, you know, they do something completely different. It is pretty unpredictable at times, which makes it fun, but makes it frustrating too.
So I'm curious, Bob. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Austin.
Oh, I was going to say, so I'm curious. You've got to hunt, you know, quite a bit or quite a range of animals. What would you say is probably like your favorite? I'm assuming I know the answer, but I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, I would say. So I haven't gotten my first bull with a bow yet or a rifle. But I'm not really even thinking about a rifle at this point. I want to get a bull with my bow.
Yeah.
So elk hunting is kind of my top choice to hunt. After that, it would be deer. It would be whitetail.
Yeah.
Bobby's too good at turkey hunting, so it's just too easy for him.
That is not true. That's not true.
He's graduated from turkey hunting. He's completed all the tasks. He's done.
No.
When I call him, talk to him about it this year, he's like, "Yeah, you know, if you know where they are and their behavior and their pattern, I mean, pretty much just go sit out there and wait for them."
That's not how I said it.
So, I was like, "Bobby, I tried that all season."
We have a neighbor at my parents' house that he has a good flock of birds on his farm. And just about every morning you drive by there, you'll see one or two toms out in one spot. So it's kind of a given at that point. If you go out there and sit, you really don't even have to call. You just sit there, and eventually they're going to come to that spot. And that's just kind of how it happened this year for me anyway.
Must be nice.
I'm jealous.
You just need to find that farm that's got a consistent bird population, and, you know, put a plan together there. That'd be a key for me, I think, if I was you.
Yeah, you know what? The frustrating thing about that is out at Austin's grandparents, we were seeing toms in one field pretty consistently. At least they were, his grandparents. And I'm sure if one of us had just sat there the entire season, we would have killed something. I mean, it was a little bit varied on when they would come, but they would be sending us pictures almost every day. And there was one hunt that was super frustrating where we got really close to a bird that morning. Austin and I were hunting together in the back and didn't quite make it happen. So we moved up to the front field where we thought they'd come out, and we gave that, I don't know, an hour and a half or so. And then we left probably, I don't know, 10:30, 11 o'clock. And we go try this other spot. And sure enough, at noon, we get a picture, and the tom is out strutting 20 yards from where we were set up. And just stuff like that, man. It's just, it's frustrating.
Yeah, definitely.
Have you started catfishing at all? I know you've been crappie fishing at a pond, so I don't know how much fishing that really is.
But it's cheating. when my son can catch more fish than me, who's four, you know, it's not really fishing. Yeah, but I haven't been a whole lot this year. I haven't been catfishing at all, and a lot of times we like to go from Missouri River up here, and we've been so busy looking for houses and land that just haven't had the time really. Yeah, but that's so, definitely one of my favorite fishing activities is trot lining and bank poling for catfish.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to hear a little bit about that because it's not something Austin and I have done. I think Austin has a buddy who does some of it, but something we want to try, and mainly because I've heard you talk a little bit about it and how fun it is. But I guess what makes it so fun? Why is it so addicting? Because people get crazy about it. They get really into it.
Yeah, it's amazing how much power a big catfish can have. There's been, I haven't caught any giant catfish, but I would say that the biggest one we caught was like a 62 pounder on Missouri. And that, just that, pulling that fish in it's almost like, you know, the peak of hunting a big buck. And you get that fish in the boat, it's like, oh my, look at this thing. And it's amazing how much power they can have when they're pulling against you on a trot line or on a bank pole. I mean, the amount of force they can put behind their tail, it can be tough to get them in the boat. So, you know, you get a fish like that that's on, you know, it's got one hook in him, and there's a good chance that hook could come out or bend before you're able to get him in the boat. So it's kind of a rushed adrenaline that you're trying to just fight that fish and make him go where you want to. But it's just the excitement. Like, you pull up to a trot line that's been out all night, you know, there's a good chance there's a fish on there. You grab a hold of, you know, the end of it, and you start feeding yourself down the line. And then you get a little tug, you can feel a little tug further down the line, and you know, there's one down there. It's an excitement to, you know, what's ahead, basically.
Mm. Yeah. And so you said the biggest one you caught was 62. I feel like I remember you talking about how you clean them. Don't you put them in like a big tub or something and let all the dirt like kind of come out of them? Is that right?
Yeah. Pro tip. Here we go. I'm not a pro by any means, but one thing we've learned is you take basically a stock tank, and you fill it with fresh water, and then put the live fish in there with an aerator. And if you just put him in there for like a day to 2 days, by the time you go to clean that fish, you won't be able to see the fish in that water. It's amazing how much it'll clean out the fish, and the meat will turn in whiter. It's amazing how much it just kind of regenerates them. So like, we'll put out lines on a Friday normally, and then we'll catch fish Saturday morning and put them in that stock tank. And, you know, and then we'll pull the lines on Sunday night normally. And so Sunday night we do all of our cleaning, because that's whenever, you know, we got to go to work the next day. So the fish that we catch on Sunday, if you clean one of those and then clean one of the ones you caught on Saturday morning and compare the meat colors, it's amazing how much different the color is in them. And I think that, you know, that turns around and that just tastes different.
Mm-hmm. How much meat did you get off the 62 pound?
I wish I knew. I don't know what the weight amount is, but it's it makes some large fillets.
Yeah,
that's sure. Crazy. Cam, that's something we need to do. We need to make a YouTube video of that. Going catfishing
and come up and
yeah,
I'd be down.
That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think it'd be awesome. Have you ever noodled, Bobby?
I have not. No, I don't.
Would you ever noodle?
I don't think I could talk myself into it. I've seen enough snapping turtles and beavers and everything that I'm going to stay away from that.
My buddy who does a lot of catfishing sent me a video of Hannah Barron and her dad, who I think is probably the most famous noodler out there. Of her reaching down and pulling up, I think it was a 65 pound and like one, it was like their first day out this year. And the that thing is like, she's not a small girl. Like, she's pretty built. And that thing was tossing her around. And I'm just like, I don't know if I would want to experience that with that big of a fish. I'm like, most of the times watching like her videos or her dad's videos, I'm like, how have you not like broken an arm or had your shoulder pulled out of socket or something?
It's pretty crazy how powerful they are. I mean, and then they get to barrel rolling.
Mm-hmm.
And if they've got your arm in there and they start barrel rolling on you. I mean, I've had fish that I couldn't get into a net that I've had to reach down and just put my hand in his mouth and pull it in the boat. And just doing that, I mean, when they bite down on your hand, you feel it.
Yeah.
And it's basically a really rough grit sandpaper on the back of your hand.
Could you imagine like a big catfish doing that?
I think that 62 pounder actually is one of the ones I had to grab and bring in the boat, which I didn't give it the chance to barrel roll on me, but it did. I can imagine it'd probably break my wrist.
Oh my gosh.
Don't you have a scar from catfishing?
I do. So that's a little bit different story. It was a small catfish. I was, probably 16, and we were fishing on the Osage River. And we kind of do the same thing on the Osage. It was actually limb lines that we were using there. But we caught a bunch of catfish, and we got back to our camper, and we were getting ready to take them out of the boat. And I reached my hand down into the tank, and normally I'll just reach down and get it behind their fin and just pin them to the bottom of the tank and then grab them and pull them out. Well, this one was, it was a little guy, and it decided it was not coming out of that tank. And so whenever I reached down and grabbed it, it flipped sideways and stuck its fin right into the meat between your thumb and your index finger.
Oof.
And out of reaction, I pull my hand out of the tank. Instead of the fish coming out of my hand, the fish came out of the tank, still attached to my hand.
Oh, so, my gosh.
That was not fun. And it almost went all the way through the meat there between my hand, my fingers. Oof. And, I remember turning my hand with the fish still in there, and I could feel the fin bone pushing against the bone in my index finger. And that was, that they have I don't know if it's called a poison or what, a toxin in their fin there that, I mean, my hand started twitching and going crazy, and it can be painful.
That probably wasn't worth it for that fish.
No, not for that one. He died pretty quickly.
Oh man. Well, I want to be respectful of your time because one, we have the same boss, and two, I know you've got plenty of work to do. So as we kind of wrap up, we do around our campfire, it's just like a little segment we like to do at the end where we give our guests an opportunity to encourage someone who's new to hunting, maybe someone who's wanting to get into catfishing, whatever it might be. And we just asked our guests to give some advice, a piece of advice for someone who's new to hunting, wanting to get into hunting. So you're up. What would you say to someone who's wanting to get into it?
Oh, man, I would say if you're wanting to get into fishing, there's a lot of knowledge out there. Try to latch on to somebody that has gone, that goes fishing often and kind of knows what they're doing, and just learn as much as you can. There's so much that I don't even know about catfishing, and I just try to any chance I can. I'm like, hey, if you want to go fishing sometime, let me know. I'd love to see how you do this, or learn the different aspects of it. There's just don't be prideful and think you know everything. Just get out there and try to go with somebody else that does. And as far as hunting goes, man. There's so much advice that I don't even know where to start on that.
I'll plant the seed in your mind, because I don't know how much Midwest has had an impact on you, but
oh my.
my thought would be find a local bow shop and a good bow shop, because a lot of those places are willing to help you out as much as possible.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know you mentioned I used to do a lot of kind of competition shooting at 3D shoots and stuff like that. When I mostly got into it, I started going to Midwest Archery there in Springfield, Missouri. And they're literally the nicest family-owned archery shop I've ever seen. It's like you go in there, as soon as you walk in the door, you know, Jill will be giving you a hug, Matt will be giving you, Jason and Brad will be giving you a hug. And, you know, they're just like, they treat you like family. Go in there and tell them what you're looking for. And they're happy to help, you know, willing to do anything they can to get you out and get you hunting. Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely find your local shop and, try to latch onto them and ask questions. You know, they're happy to help, you know, most shops I've seen. So, just don't be afraid to ask the questions and learn from those people.
Yeah. I want to echo something before we sign off that Cam was kind of saying earlier. You know, this past season, we had a really good season and we learned a lot. And, you know, I don't think it would have been nearly as successful had it not been for guys like you and others who really invested in us. And, you know, Bobby, you've taught me a lot through Cam that has helped me become a better hunter. So I just want to say thank you to you. And to everyone else that has really helped us. I feel like we this year gained a lot of knowledge and became more experienced, and kind of, instead of taking, you know, one step forward, we took like three or four this season and becoming better hunters, more knowledgeable when it comes to especially deer hunting. So thank you very much for all the time you've spent mentoring Cam and, you know, sharing stories and all that. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Cameron's been really good at just kind of randomly coming over to my desk and saying, hey, what do you think about hunting out of tree saddles? Or, hey, how would you hunt this buck? And that's, you know, like I said, just ask questions. You know, if you know somebody that's good at deer hunting or good at elk hunting or turkey or whatever you're after, don't be afraid to ask the questions. And, mm-hmm. you know, most people out in the outdoor world are willing to help and really looking to help other hunters get into it. So like I said, don't be afraid to ask questions. And, you know, everyone wants to be as good as they can at it. So that's kind of the way I see it anyway.
Yeah. I'd echo what Austin said. You know, I appreciate all the advice that you've given me, and you definitely helped me a lot, not just this year, but, the past couple years hunting. And this year, like I already said, you get some credit because I used your tree saddle, right?
And yeah.
I also killed two deer with two of your arrows. So you're like an investor.
Those are my spine floated arrows, right?
That's right. They've got the little mark on them where the spine is. So I know put the spine up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I went with. So. All right. Well, Bobby, we better get back to work, but definitely appreciate you being on, man. Excited to bug you more. Probably be calling you tomorrow to ask you more questions, but we appreciate all the stories. Appreciate you being on. With that, don't give up. All it takes is just one.
Hey guys, it's Cam. Wanted to take a quick second during this podcast to give a plug to One Stringer. It's a company we've been working for here, really for the past couple years, and they, customize arrow wraps, limb wraps. They even started doing fishing rod wraps recently, which is really cool. It's an awesome way for you to customize your own gear, to give your own little touch, to your gear. And some people think it gives them an edge. I don't know, but it's something that we've used the past couple years and really enjoyed. Go check them out. They're a great company and they'll be happy to hook you guys up.